My name is Max.
My name is Yuri Lowenthal.
My name is Travis Sintel.
And you are awaited.
You are awaited.
Do you remember what the show is?
It's a podcast that spent a year on the Fury Road analyzing the internal intricacies of Yuri Lowenthal and Travis Sintel's ids, egos, and superegos. It was a journey through cinematic brilliance. It was a dissection of philosophical tropes. It was a Joseph Campbellian adventure into the inner heart and inner sanctums of the collective human experience. And here we are for a special episode of You Are Awaited.
Because you know what our show was missing? Not enough Colin Gibson.
You know what? We did that. Let me ask you a question, Yuri.
Yeah.
Before we get into Colin Gibson,
yeah,
we have
a call
scheduled. How the fuck are you? It's been a little bit.
It has been a little bit. I'm doing okay. I've missed you.
I missed you too, Yuri.
I've missed the show. I've missed talking about Fury Road. I've missed seeing your face. I know you've been gone. You were in India for
a while. I was in India. I was on the Fury Indian Road.
Yeah.
And it was beautiful. It was great. I had a nice time.
You were on the Curry Road.
The Curry Road.
Oh, that took me longer than I am.
Have you been writing that since I left?
I've been writing that since you left.
Like, I hope we get another guest because I have this
because
joke.
I have this joke.
I have to unload.
Right.
I'm going crazy not telling this joke. I do want to say this, that we have gotten some amazing emails from fans.
We have. Ian Tavner's email brought me to tears.
Yeah, man. Just sweet stuff and really beautiful. And I'm happy that we have a chance. I'm happy that we have an excuse to do this other episode. Hopefully we'll get a couple more guests. They're still in the works. But I'm happy we at least have this just to touch base and say thanks to everybody one more time. It's been really cool. And you know, we started this thinking that the two of us would just get together and basically mentally jerk off on each other for you know, a year of Mad Max. But to hear that other people wanted to jerk off with us, this metaphor is falling apart.
No, but you know what I mean. No, you keep going down that road.
Other grown men wanted to jerk off with us. At the same time,
women listen
to us. I don't know how many women we have. Maybe like five.
Carly, you know, I don't know if Carly is a woman or a man. I think she's a woman.
No, that was a nice.
She called us out on the Jamaican dude thing.
Yeah, yeah.
That you know, because we sort of made fun of. You know, I don't think that's the same guy at the end. As you know, the guy.
I made fun of you in the moment.
No, you did.
To be fair.
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough. but she said, "I'm not talking about that guy. I'm talking about this other guy who pops up at 6 minutes and 19 seconds." Now, I have not done my due diligence and gone to check her, but thank you for clarifying.
I mean, around 6 minutes would be that chase sequence, though, would it not? Where he sees the flashback? That's the guy you're talking about, right?
No, because she compares the two. And the first one, and she shows the...
Okay.
It's something we'll have to look into that, you know, once again, if we were professionals, I would have looked up.
Can I be honest? I won't look into it.
You want
just being real?
Can I be honest? We're not professionals.
That's also true. Everyone who is listening at this point knows that. Please keep up the relationship, and we're happy to get emails and tweet. And if nothing comes of this podcast, but having a new set of friends and a new community, then it is certainly worth it to me.
Absolutely.
And I hope.
Otherwise,
that
we wouldn't
continues.
Have set up a Twitter that I check occasionally, or an email address. Otherwise, we would have just made it impossible for you to get in touch with us.
Yeah, I put the Twitter notifications on my phone from that account, so I see that shit.
Yeah, you do.
I'm not even a Twitterer, and I see that shit. So
you
know what I did? This is again off topic, but let's why not? It's what we do.
It's our show.
I set up,
and it's been a while since they've. You know, seen or heard from us.
Heard us ramble. I don't use Hootsuite, but I connect my Facebook to my Twitter, so everything you see me tweet is just from Facebook.
Oh, I do the opposite because I hate being
You're
on
Twitter
Facebook.
First.
So when I tweet something, it goes to my Facebook.
I like to fight with people in longer form
on Facebook.
So that's really Facebook becomes
bless your heart. I've lost all energy to fight with people anymore.
Oh, it invigorates me. It makes me pleased. I just think it's fun to sort of hear those opinions. I use the word fight a little facetiously.
I know.
I like
you know, I've seen you quote unquote fight on Facebook, and you were very reasoned and methodical and patient with with your fight.
It's a warm bath fight.
It is a warm bath.
I want to massage you while I deconstruct your worldview.
While we're jerking off together in a warm bath.
Look, watch us jerk off. Let's talk about the world. We'll sort it out, man. Anyway, we do have a Colin Gibson today.
We do. And we also need to come up with a way for you and I to hang out, because I haven't seen Travis since we finished this podcast, and then all this time went by, and we just need to not let the internet be the thing that pushes us back together.
Yeah, I agree. Yuri and I are very open. Mm-hmm. A number of you have tweeted at us about this. I won't give you the exact numbers, but there's been a substantive amount saying you guys should go into a new subject and keep podcasting. I'm down.
I'm absolutely down.
So we're going to talk about that off screen, but if you have other ideas off screen, I'm drunk, off air. But if you do have other ideas about things that you would like us to discuss, we are down to do that, or even special guest episode or special episode in this podcast world. We can consider that also.
Yeah.
We're desperate.
We're desperate.
Yeah.
If you're desperate for more Tom Hardy, can I recommend, and I'll recommend this straight to your face because we haven't talked about
it,
Taboo.
I haven't seen it yet.
Taboo is so fucking good, Travis.
Is it good?
And nobody's talking about it. I don't know if I'm just stupid. It's like history porn. It's so good.
You know what I haven't loved?
What?
Westworld.
Really?
Yeah.
I really enjoyed Westworld.
It's fine.
Okay. It's not as, in my opinion, it's not as good as, I like Taboo better.
Yeah, I want to watch Taboo.
But I loves me some Jimmy Simpson.
Yeah.
And getting to see this much Jimmy Simpson is great. It was full of nice things for me. What was it that you didn't?
You know, I think Westworld. We're off the rails here again, Yuri, but let's do it.
We'll get to Colin Gibson in a second. Yeah. We've got him hanging out in a little corral here. It's like, Colin, you don't mind, right? You don't mind that we're getting to you.
Colin waits for us. you know, I think it feels like a failed experiment where I love the concept, love the art direction, the art design of that show is incredible. Mm-hmm. Performances are great, but they tried to hang all of their emotional weight on robots. And the main characters that were supposed to sort of, which is an interesting cognitive experiment to try.
Right.
But I found myself wanting to really be into it. But every time it was time to watch another episode, I had to make myself do it. I'm on episode 7 now. I just do it because I feel like, well, I should finish the season.
Sure, you're a completionist.
Yeah, I try to like give everything its day in court. You know, and these days, you know, a 10-episode season is just a 10-hour movie, really.
Right.
So you have to like give it its full day in
Taboo,
court.
I think Taboo, Alas and Alack, is only 8 episodes. They're 6 episodes in. Tonight actually will be 7.
Yeah.
But keep going. Sorry.
No, I was just going to say that I think putting your emotional arc weight on robots is a neat idea, but ultimately doesn't really land for me, and I think it's just questionable storytelling. On that tip, please tune in. I think November. I think I can announce that I'm working on a show with Bryan Cranston and Ron Moore, which is a Philip K. Dick adaptation show. My writing partner and
Way
I
to
are writing
bury the lead.
Well, we're writing one of the episodes. I don't even know they've announced the show. They haven't announced that we're writing on it, but I feel like that's fine. Take a look. We were one of the episodes of a 10-episode season, and it's got Travis Beecham, who wrote Pacific Rim. It's got Ron Moore, wrote one from Battlestar Galactica. Bryan Cranston's going to be in one. Michael Denner wrote one. Dee Reese wrote one. It's a cool group of writers and directors.
You're my hero.
God, can I just say that you're my hero?
Wow, is that
weird?
It's not weird, but it may signal the time when we should probably finally introduce our guest.
Let's pull our dicks out. Let's open up Skype.
Let's put our dicks away for the moment.
Let's agree to disagree.
It's hard to put my dick away when I'm not wearing pants.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Colin Gibson.
He created a lot, and it was the mastermind behind so much of what you saw in Fury Road and so many other movies. Colin Gibson, thank you for coming to the show today.
My pleasure.
If you can believe it, this is a podcast that we've done for a year, 52 episodes. Every episode was about Fury Road. This is not a movie podcast where we talk about a lot of movies. This is because Travis and I were so in love and taken with
Fury Road that we just kept talking about it, and we thought, you know what? Maybe some other people want to hear this stuff too. We've had some great guests on, some people who I believe you've worked with, Brendan McCarthy and Matt Bau, at least worked with tangentially. We work
much closer than tangentially.
Excellent. That's what I like to hear. And so much of what we, as we go through the film, the things that strike us are the designs, are the, you know, the look and how deep everything goes. Nothing is surface. Nothing is put there just because it looks cool. There's a story behind everything. And so much of the design tells the story without having to, you know, be bogged down with lots of dialogue explaining things or, you know, useless exposition. And
well, it's sort of, it was a terrible feedback here, whether it's my end.
Oh, you have feedback there? Let's see.
It wouldn't be from that.
Now, let me dial down just the volume on this side just to see if...
How's that?
All right. How's that sound to you? Better or worse?
Yeah, no, it's more my end. I could more than be happy listening to both of you. It's hearing my own voice that is a
sorry about
unusual punishment.
Right. Do you have headphones? That may take care of that.
No, it's okay now.
Okay.
I've managed to quash at least two of the inner voices.
We're only down to six. This is fantastic. Great.
So the story itself, basically. Led to, it's one of those, you know, you design for the project, and a project that pretty much is a race for the first half and a chase for the second half is moving at 100 kilometers an hour constantly with three small rest breaks from the girls in the back saying, are we there yet? the only way to actually try to get across a sense of the world was to layer and build it into everything that was there. You know, we were introducing what we called characters.
Why did we never see that?
Briefly, and then, 15 seconds later, the vehicle and the four guys on it are consigned to a fireball and a bloody death. So it's only in those few beats that their weaponry, their scarring, their outfits, and their vehicles give you a chance to sort of feel that the world is authentic.
It really is effective. You know, there's something we had talked about earlier in the podcast. James Joyce said that it took me 30 years to write Ulysses. It should take you 30 years to read it. Which made me never read Ulysses by James Joyce. But the idea being that someone takes that much time to pack a book and pack a sentence with meaning, intent, creation, and we know the long gestation period of this film, it felt like it deserved time to unpack. And there was a subconscious sense when we watched it the first time that all the things you're saying were true, that someone had taken the time to actually exposit characters and build characters, even though they were on screen for 2 minutes before being exploded into a fireball, that... You know, I wonder if we pushed on this, if it would hold up, and it did. And I guess our first question, well, before we get into this, do you want to give our listeners some background of how you came to do what you do? I think that would be interesting for people to hear.
Well, it was just one of those choices. You steal a few cars, you get in with the wrong crowd.
As you do.
The police offer you, you know, one or two options. And filmmaking just seemed to be a little easier than most of the others. No, I was an actor, but then I had children and they wanted to eat. And most of the shows that I'd been in, I'd eventually ended up either taking over the lighting or the stage design or the production management or something, just to give me something more to do. I like to own too much of everything. Mm-hmm. So basically, I went from acting and theatre work and strangely sort of fell into film through being a standby props guy. So I've always been of the theory that either from the actor's point of view or even from the props point of view, you have to be able to try to imbue each of those beats with as much of the story as humanly possible, and then you can make everything real. Also, as a you know, working on a lot of much lower budget Australian jobs, you know, you can only afford trying to explain to a director that it'd be great if we could shoot that wide shot, but you don't have the money. So we're going to invest in this really, really beautiful antique biro and a piece of paper. And we can't cut away to the war, but you will be able to have someone write a really nice postcard about it.
There was something Matt Bell said that kind of caught our attention. He said, you know, in explaining some of the construction of the props of the film and some of the cars and motorcycles, he said, well, we finished the motorcycles and moved on, and they were looking for somewhere else to put me. And I said, wait, we've been around film for 20 years here in Los Angeles. We've never heard anyone working in props say we finished something and moved on because we were happy with it. Is that a unique experience for you? Did you feel satisfied with a lot of the things you were able to create, or did you feel stymied or crunched by budget or time?
Oh, no, well, I couldn't really put my hand up and say I was stymied by time.
good.
Brendan McCarthy, I think, came to George in 97 or 98, wanting to just say, thank you very much, I love your stuff, and here's a couple of graphic novels. And they got talking and realised that George had in his mind another story. And maybe Brendan was a great choice to work it through. By the time they added Peter Pound and then eventually Mark Sexton, they had they'd managed to write a show with at that stage about 1,400 or 1,500 storyboards, but no script. So when I was offered the job, the great joy was being able to sit down for a month, listen to George tell the tell, and sort of walk you through the boards, and then decide that there already were a whole lot of drawings. You know, they weren't very specific. Some of Brendan's concept art was gorgeous, but was not really sort of cleaving to the reality of that world if you were going to do it. He's a fantastic, a fantasist, I would say, mm-hmm. And he had some beautiful stuff. Unfortunately, I'm a little more tied to physics, and I believe that there's really only the hair stands up on your neck when you defy gravity rather than when you pretend it doesn't exist in the Fast and Furious system.
Yes, absolutely, I agree.
So we sort of embraced the real physics, we embraced rules, and then we invented all of our others, so... By sitting down and writing a sort of a tribal Bible, and the clue to that was that George always considered this to be someone looking back and retelling that story. He tends to work that way. It's the Joseph Campbell in him. So he was imagining that what we were watching unfold was actually being referred to from yet another future, and that history man looking back and telling this anthropological tale was a great excuse for me to sit down and pretend I was Margaret Mead and actually start sort of specifying, writing and backstorying each of the tribes, separating them out and sort of giving them a much greater background and coloration. And then that sort of fed into, you know, if you find out what drives a character before you find out what he drives, then you don't just go for cute and cool. You've got reasons, storyline. You've got DNA to work with.
Yeah.
All of which is way off the point of was I happy with the motorbikes? No, I just had to get Matty off them. He really was twiddling and doing again. So, and we also, that sort of, basically I got Matt off, I'm sure he would have told you, for working on the claw.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
Which was an ongoing project. George and I had George introduced me to Charlize, I recall, by saying, "This is Colin. He and I disagree about everything," which wasn't true, but you know, it was you know, there was a lot of variation.
Those stories do come up, Colin, just so you know. There's a lot of legacy stories about, well, Colin and George were disagreeing about X. That's a lead in to half the stories we heard.
Right. We've also, I was negligent in forgetting and saying, not saying that the Mark Sexton has also been on the show. We've heard stories from several different places. There's a story that I'd love to get you to corroborate that I love in having talked to Matt about. He said that when they were building things, they were allowed sort of free run of like a junkyard type area, and you said, you know, whatever you can scavenge from here you can use, and apparently would in the middle of the night or when people would walk away from their bench, some designers would go and steal parts from other designers even throughout the course of building these things, and you had to hide all the good pieces if you wanted to keep them. Can you corroborate that? Because I think it's one of my favorite stories.
Yeah, well, part of the design process, we decided early on, the War Boys themselves were cobbling together this new fall toward feudalism out of the little that was left, and you know, pointing it toward survival. So basically, we went out and found. I went one direction. Laurie Fain went another. We found an awful lot of vehicles, hit the paddocks and back garages, and pulled out passion projects and rusting hulks from up and down the seaboard. And then specific vehicles that we really wanted to use, we found sort of, you know, on the net or overseas, schlepped them in, and then basically did that pile. I also hit a couple of factories that were closing down, you know, went to pay the nice man at the gate a small amount of money so that we could come in and help ourselves, you know, tell them that, you know, this glass factory in Alexandria was closing down and the guys were getting robbed every night, you know. Locals were going over, leaping the fence and, you know, stealing whatever they could by hand. And I just said, you know, why don't we formalize this? I'll come back tomorrow with a few friends and here's $1,000. He was surprised to see five trucks, but he just didn't know how friendly I was. And we went back and put that pile together. Obviously, it's what you choose to put in the pile. It had to be something that you could repurpose, that you could look at anew with the new parameters of, you know, how do I survive? How does this help me survive? How does this help my cargo faster or my weapon hurt heavier? And also a sort of longing for a misremembered past. I always liked that sort of look. You know, that look a Labrador gives a toilet roll when it's not quite sure whether to eat it, fuck it, play with it, push it around.
Yuri's giving me that look right now, Colin.
Yeah. Colin, Yuri, you would have loved it. So anyway, we put those big piles together, and then the guys, you know, we would take what I referred to. Matt was one of our salvage artists. Jono or Mark, one of the mechanics. And then we'd just go and sit down and say, okay, this is the story of this vehicle. All we really know about it from the storyboards is that we see it and 15 seconds later we ram it from behind and it bursts into flame. Now, what we do know is that it tracks with this other vehicle, and we know that you know, if it does hang with this other vehicle, maybe it's in love with the other vehicle. Maybe the driver here has a, you know, homoerotic relationship with the people eater who's driving the other giant fractionating truck. So if he wants to love it, then he's going to want it look like that. So, well, what does he look like? Well, he's got a sort of a big fat bald head and sticky out ears and a syphilitic nose. Yeah, that looks like a Volkswagen. So we'll start with the Volkswagen and then we'll work our way up. Well, he comes from Gastown. What did we say about Gastown? Gastown is sort of homoerotic by virtue of there not being any women. It's all like oil rig, fly in but no fly out. Nothing but guys. So they sort of went a bit gym junky and they're also out on the flat. All they've got is fuel, so their weapons are going to be mostly flamethrowers. But they're out on the big flat and they need something tall so they can see people coming at them. So we give them poles up the crow's nest, wearing my gym junkie, he's got a syphilitic nose because George loves the idea that it's rotting. And so therefore, if the leader's syphilitic, let's say quite a few of the others are. And also, you know what? I can only find three or four guys who are really good at climbing poles at 40 feet high at 100 kilometers an hour off-road bouncing around. So if I put a mask on them, those four guys can become 8 or 12. Wow. And I can kill as many as I like. So they became masks. And then each of that, the fetishizing would change depending on, you know, where they came from and who they were with. And then their weapons would change based on the same thing. And then if I'm up a pole, then I need something that's motorized or that I can wear as a backpack, like a little leaf blower or a hedge trimmer. That's a good, you know. Mm. So all of those, each of those things fed one into the other. Once you've got a, you know, a solid belief and you know where you are, the guys could go out and, yes, decide what bits sort of suited. And yes, the bastards would go in there late at night and secrete things under their benches so that nobody would get, you know, the little Mack truck symbol or this really cool doll's head that I just want to sort of hit with a torch, melt, blow, and then force teeth back into.
Ugh. Were so, you, you know, trying?
There was a beautiful feedback loop that was happening, but only because we decided on the anthropology first.
I have a lot of questions about that, but
yeah. although I could hear you tell the evolution of each of the vehicles and each of the little pieces of things for years. But Travis, please.
Did you intentionally create a sort of competitive environment? Was that part of the Machiavellian sort of overseeing of that, or was that just a byproduct of that?
No, look, I think George likes words like mastermind. I'm a little less Machiavellian. I work more on the theory that the great joy of doing films for me is immersing yourself in another world and then rebuilding that world from the inside out. And the best way that I can do that is to use the skills and talents and passions of all these other people, all these other guys you've had on for 51 other weeks. Fantastic, and they're a resource. And you don't, it's not competitive, I don't think, except in the way that, you know, every war boy would be competitive. Everyone wants to have the most aspirated carburetor, the biggest tires, the largest spread on the diff, the most explosive weapon, the fuck me, whose idea was it to you? What, coins are no good anymore, but they make great shrapnel. So, you know, I'm going to make a thunder stick that's full of quarters. Now, that's a great idea. George did often walk around the workshop, and we were sort of given free range. He was on another job. Also, you know, we tend to operate a little better. If you're going to argue with someone all the time, it's better you keep them down to, you know, once every couple of months.
That's how me and my girlfriend operate, Colin.
What a pity you've spent so much time building that. I don't like it. Or I was on the way here and I passed a tanker and it had this little curvy thing. And I said, George, we finished the tankers 2 months ago. Yeah, but look, I've just seen one. So, I don't believe Machiavellian that sort of evil version of competitiveness. What it was everybody was instilling in everybody the passion and allowing them to be free with skills that they had, and then also finding them. You can force someone, you know, you go and you watch, we had a great panel beater, Mark Natoli. You go and watch people work and you see the skills that he's got that don't get used anymore. You know, there's not a lot of people anymore on your carbon fiber Corolla that you bother with an English wheel, putting a soft, you know, tiny compound curve into a piece of steel and molding, melding, stretching. And yet he had these skills. And so when we came to look at things like, let's say the Nux's exhaust pipes, well, you know, okay, we can put them out. I'd really like them to have flames embossed into them. But I find it's a bit like tattoos. I've sort of, you know, I don't want us to have tattoos. I find it all, it's all a bit naff. Once my mother got, you know, the I Ching and a dolphin just above her clitoris, I sort of lost interest in the whole thing.
This is going to be weird. I've met your mother, though, Colin, I should tell you. Yeah, go on.
Oh, no, you may well have met her. Were you ever a sailor?
Absolutely. Okay, that makes a lot of sense.
Okay. So basically, I don't, where was I?
We were dolphin clitoris. I think your mother.
Into it, I get all so confused.
Tattoos are naff.
Yeah.
Tattoos were naff. So is there another way to tattoo the steel? And originally, you know, he said, oh no, that we used to at Tech, we had this system where we couldn't, you know, we didn't have the embossing machines and things, and to put it into a compound curved object. So what he did was we welded two flat pipes. And then just use water pressure. So it's just a pump that's purely physical, completely analog. And then you pump the water pressure in until it stretches those steel. And as long as the welds hold, you bow out to a curve. You end up with an exhaust pipe tube, and it has folded into it the flames and patterns. Now that's because somebody had that talent, had that skill. And was prepared to do it, to add it to where we were, you know, or we'd find a way of welding. You know, I had this idea of henna tattooing on some of the stuff. If you were going to tattoo, that sort of, you know, henna, beautiful henna work that was detailed and caring that we put onto one of the Volvolini motorbikes. And then I said, well, what about butching it up? And we did it on one of the tow trucks. You know, we started to weld and use the, you know, the offcuts and the overweld to actually patinate. Of course, you know, by the time you had to do four or five of those vehicles, you did start using the squeegee silicon gun and painting over it. But you know, the idea was there. So we were using, trying to work out ways to do it that they would have had to do it, and reasons to do it that a group of guys lost and bereft, who are forced to point everything they find at survival, and yet who also have to not lose a yearning for the beauty, for the civilization that was lost, for all this shit that came down to us, the beauty of the V8 engine, the gun, the condom, you know, whatever you found that you've salvaged together. Mm-hmm. What the fuck is it? How do I use it? And Jesus, how did these guys, if they had this, how did they end up leaving me this total shit fight of a world? Yeah.
There's been a lot of... Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, in interviews and speeches I've seen you give, you're very quick to give away credit and to draw the attention away from yourself and to really re-explain to people who either... don't know that or have forgotten that movies are not made by a single person's vision or a single person's work. I so much appreciate that idea. And in getting all of your guys together, guys and gals, whoever you had on your team, I know that you had sort of basic rules for everything that was being created. You talk about, you know, the anthropology, the history and philosophy of the thing and the physics and the, you know, down to the gods. I mean, you had to look at all that stuff. Now, is that a discussion you had with all members of your team, or was that something that happened higher up that you sort of agreed on and then you gave them sort of the distilled down ideas?
No, I tried to, you've heard me rabbit on. Distilling ideas? Don't be ridiculous. No, I mean, I think the hardest thing, I mean, I'll tell you, the birth of it was probably in George telling the tell. I don't know, from the earlier Mad Maxes, you know, where the young girl and the kids in crashed landing plane world, you know, I was telling the tell now, looking back, you know, down past history back to when Mr. Walker came and gave us all the oak. You know, so right. Basically George walked me through the storyboards and told me the tell. And I have a slightly different, you know, obviously a slightly different way of telling and talking. And I think sometimes George felt I wasn't quite quite as loving of it as he was. But I just have a slightly more, you know, I need to make it fun and funny. Yeah. And also I had to do it to a huge different crowd of talents and sensibilities.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right down to the fact, the first time I was in Africa, 2003, Jesus, there were three Australians on the crew. I found a couple of South African mechanics. I had one New Zealand guy, and then everyone else was African or Namibian. And they had no way of, you know, minimal or less, they had no way of really understanding. So as we got a core group of people, I would, on a Friday night, put up the storyboards just on a little rough animatic that I made, and then I would do all the voices and talk my way through through the show. So some of those guys saw a rather sarcastic version of Fury Road way back in 2003, and you know, it was a great way to try to bring them all in. But no, I don't think we never tried to say, you know, we're having the high-level conversations. You guys in the trenches just go in there and build me something with a V8 and then blow it up.
This is something we keep coming across interviewing people from the film. We started off just breaking down the film and then got access to some of the people and thought it might be interesting to sort of ask their perspective on it. I've been watching a lot of old Robert Zemeckis films, and what strikes me about that guy is that the difference between... He could have put a lot less effort into his movies, and they would have been fine, good movies. Roger Rabbit is fine without all the extra loaded gags and background scenes and sort of hidden gags. Back to the Future is fine without some of those extra details. But he's obsessive about it, you can tell. And he really put all this extra effort into making it a masterpiece or a great film. And you see this constantly in Mad Max Fury Road. I would say that, you know, you can't. It's impossible to get everything from one watch in that film. It's too loaded with stuff. And so you have to expect that the filmmakers are a little obsessive about making something that's holistic, complete, and holds up to scrutiny. Knowing that most of your audience will not catch most of what you do, what drives you to put that level of detail in? Is it your own personal need to make it great? Is it the opportunity, the creativity, or is it the subconscious feel that the audience might get, even though they don't catch it or clock it consciously?
Yeah, look, from my point of view, I mean, I'm sure George does. I don't really think about it from the point of view of, you know, will the audience get this gag or not? You put so much time, heart, effort, love into what you're making, that you want it to be the most entire thing it can be. George would walk around the workshop and go, "Oh, Colin, you know, you don't need, you know, what a pity, we'll never see that. You know, you've just carved a teeny tiny blah into the dashboard of this car. And why would, you know, we'll never see it." And I would always say, "Well, you're the director. If it's that good, make sure we see it." And he would go, "You know, I've got other fish to fry. I'm destroying something else. You know, no, you can't have that." You know, that little, we'd put, you know, one of those, I on the Volkswagen, we put a lot of effort into that being a huge, there was a convex mirror that we put on the back of it, like one of those, you know, coming around a blind corner mirrors. And I stuck it in a particular spot wedged into the corner because I had always imagined a shot where the guy would be surprised by the truck that was hurtling up to destroy him, and that was my cut. And it didn't get shot that way. George far better than I knew that, you know, the speed that he was cutting it at, we'd never get to it. So that was something that was there that meant something to me, that was important. We had carved into the Volkswagen, into the dashboard, was FKD, which was basically, which is short for fucked. But You know, nobody in the world is going to know that originally the Volkswagen was denoted in the factory by the words KFD, which, my German's a bit, Kraft durch Freude, which from the same group that bought you Arbeit macht frei.
Right.
It basically meant strength through joy was Hitler's idea of the, you know, the little car for the whole, for the every man of Germany.
Right.
And so in a world where you're cobbling things together and it's non-literal and you don't really have a written language anymore, only those, you know, higher levels still have managed to maintain that. The slight dyslexia of KFD turning into fucked, turning into the Volkswagen that was strength through joy, is a terrific amount of fun for someone with my warped sensibility, but doesn't necessarily translate to, boy, I hope, what are those stupid schmucks at home? What do you mean they voted for Donald Trump, but they can't get a simple bit of historical alliteration?
Right. A bit of German punnery goes well in the Trump administration, we've learned.
Exactly. I mean, you know, so we had, you know, little things carved into people, you know, who put the F in utility? Because, you know, here in Australia, the car with the work platform on the back is a ute, a utility. And of course, you know, futility was one of our main backstory lines. So there's a whole lot of stuff that's there, but it's there because it makes it realer for us and for everyone else who's there. It was one of the main reasons that George wanted to do this last great action movie as really, as truthfully, and as mechanically appropriately as possible. So that's why we decided, instead of the, you know, the system that usually happens is you design something way cool, and then you go out and you build it the cutest, lightest way possible, and then the special effects guys come in and have to do five different versions of it in three different sorts of steel and two sorts of plastic so that we can get all of the gags and the stunts and the bits out of it. We actually designed the characters so that they were capable of doing their own stunts. They're not just actors, they're also stunt people. It's built into what they have to be because there's a shortage of materials. And sometimes that meant that because I happened to have found three matching Jags that we used for one of the convoy vehicles, we happened to find three of them, two in one yard and one, you know, 1,100 kilometres away in a paddock. Now, they were all three pretty much the same model, so that meant that I had something where I knew I needed a double and where I knew I also had another that I could mount. So that sort of chose itself as a vehicle, which didn't work out all that well because I think George never really liked the Jaguar that much. And so I just kept trying to foist it on him because I had three of them. And I had to keep changing, you know, trying to modify, give it spats, give it a bigger gun, put an extra guy in it, you know, heighten the back, anything to try to sell it to him because I had three of them and it was required that I needed three for that gag. And, you know, eventually we did foist it on him, but deep down, I don't think he really liked it that much.
I would like to see your characters and raise you a Carmada, which is what we've been referring to, the wide wedges of vehicles. But you brought up, you know, this is not something I was originally going to ask, but you started it when you brought up Thunderdome and Captain Walker. But it's a widely shared belief on our end, and I think your end too, that the third film is a bit of an aberration and doesn't quite carry the legacy the same way that, you know, the first two films did. And do you, because of what we've been talking about, now I know George was dealing with issues that I can't even imagine having to deal with and deliver a film at the time, but do you feel that what really made that film not come together quite the same way was the lack of attention to detail, or the lack of creating everything from using those, you know, looking through the anthropology, the history, the philosophy, and it becoming more of something that just looked cool and didn't always necessarily make sense?
Yeah, look, I must admit one of the ongoing lines between George and I was that I took the job so that he wouldn't make Thunderdome again.
Uh-huh.
And unfortunately, I'm sort of as aggravatingly brutal as that most of the time to talk to, which, you know, possibly makes me a slightly abrasive collaborator. So, no, George, it looks too much like Thunderdome. And then George would, you know, come back and go, I really think at the Citadel we should have a Thunderdome, like a giant, you know, and I'm like, no!
Uh-huh.
Look, it is an aberration, and for those of us who didn't really respond as well to Thunderdome, it's got a fantastic opening image. Mm-hmm. I think the camels dragging the vehicle across the desert is mm-hmm. utterly gorgeous. I think there's some beautiful beats in it,
mm-hmm.
but I do think that it's one of those things. Why does a dog lick its balls? Because it can. And suddenly, if you've got a shitload of money, then you're led into doing, you know, all the stuff that seems cool. And you do start to just sort of, you know, let's throw this in and we'll play with the Geiger counter and the gags, and everybody will be dressed up and they'll be funny. It just, the whole thing felt a little shallow. And there were, you know, there were two or three completely separate storylines all fighting to meet, you know. So there's, the kids are out in the desert not just because they're a completely different world. They're also a whole different way of thinking and way of surviving. And so connecting them was a bit odd. I think the main problem with Thunderdome was, from my point of view, was that it really did. It was all about surface and not about the real physics and the real world. And I think George realized that, and I think that's why, you know, we were all so eager to develop a lasting and real framework that could stand on its own internal logic.
Well, that's why I think this interplay that you're talking about is what we've come to decide. I think I'm speaking for Yuri here, but
feel free to.
Okay, good. I've come to decide is kind of why the film works, and hearing you sort of explicate it makes a lot of sense. That the intuition about a movie that's been storyboarded for 1,400 storyboards for, you know, 12 years is that you know precisely the shots you're going to get, so you only design for the shots that you're going to shoot. What you're saying is, no, we designed a full world and told George to go play in it. So that's counterintuitive, but that precise thing is why the movie feels so loaded. There's tons of background stuff that George didn't have time to shoot that we see if we choose to dig into it. And also, subconsciously, this is not your intention going in, but there is a weird subconscious weight to background details in a film, in a world-building film, that's new to us. I mean, we haven't seen a movie that does that, be it Star Wars or, you know, Star Trek or any other world-building type environments. They're always designed for the shot you're getting, and the backgrounds aren't especially interesting. So there's a psychological weight to this film that comes from, you know, having this interplay between you and, it sounds like, George. And so my question, all that is to lead up to, are there any disagreements that you want to talk about beyond shoot this thing or I built this thing, why don't you shoot it, that you want to talk about in terms of George? Because I think the interplay between the two of you, from most people we've interviewed, seems to be the driving force behind the depth and complexity of the film.
Well, suddenly it sounds like if George is the oyster, then I'm the bit of shit that may or may not have helped become a pearl. But it's all the other layers that get stuck over the grit that make the pearl, and all those other layers are everybody else. So there's a pretty good the world is your oyster. George is the oyster. I'm the bit of grit, and I'd like to thank everybody else on the credit list for adding layers of lustrous pearl. Look, there was some fantastic, some not just disagreements. I mean, what it is you have a slightly different approach, and I was lucky. We were all lucky that the way it operated was that we did get a chance to, you know, to surge ahead and build, and we did get a chance to make things. You know, there were probably three or four main gags that were where George and I were at variance. And I think because of that interplay, because of that tension, it actually became a better thing. I'd say the main ones were, you know, Furiosa's prosthetic arm was one of them. The polecats was another. George had invented the polecats in his head as if in a dream. You know, he'd seen them coming across the world, and they were on pole vaults. They were bending. They were attacking, and the tension wasn't so much about using them, but about how they would operate. And I was not clever enough to come up with a way to make a pole vault, a bendy object, do what George needed it to do at 100 kilometres an hour off-road with a real human being at the top. And George's never thought we would. His response was, it's not going to be safe, it's not really going to operate, and anyway, Colin, you stupid Luddite, we can do it with CG.
Right. You
know, it'll be much safer, it'll be terrific, whereas I just kept worrying at it and hitting it with a stick. And I came back to it. We had, you know, three or four different versions. We had a sort of a bungee web version. We had a couple of different counterweight versions. Guy Norris, the stunt guy, was desperate to make it work as well. He, you know, really wanted to be able to do it for real. But George started to get quite aggravated with me because I kept coming back saying, look, George, we've got this version. We put a V8 motor on the back. We run up exactly the weight, we put another guy on the bottom, and by counterweighting, now you don't get the bend in the pole that you drew in that storyboard in 2000, but we do get the physics of it. And think of it like this, it's like a ballet of metronomes coming down the road. It also gives you a set distance, you know, you can play with the drops, it'll be... It just doesn't let it, and he goes, no, I want it to bend. And
anyway, man.
Fortunately, we went to Broken Hill to do tests, and we took our counterweight versions, and the stunt guys and PJ Votan shot a whole lot of this footage and sent it back to George, who was on Happy Feet at the time, and said, what do you think? And he said, that's pretty amazing, I guess. Are you sure it's safe? That's a problem with being a doctor. He's taken a Hippocratic oath. He's not supposed to hurt anyone, whereas most of my oaths are to hurt someone.
Yeah.
So, you know, so the pole vault was one, you know, the polers, that counterweight system was an ongoing battle. But the desire to do it for real and to make George's vision work just meant you had to slightly amend the vision and then make it work. And the claw was another, you know, George had got stuck in his mind that it wasn't a disability, that it was to make her more enabled, which was true. But I had a big problem with it. My first image of that claw came from a picture I'd seen of a guy in a refugee camp who'd lost, you know, the hootsie tootsie, you know, do you want short sleeves or long sleeves? We're going to cut off your arm. Do you want it above or below? And this guy in the camp had made a prosthesis for the only two things he needed to do. One of them was a spoon that sat onto the end of the, and it was a battered little silver spoon, and it just wedged into a piece of tin that went onto his stump. And the other thing he needed to do was to smoke roaches, and so he had a tiny wire roach clip that replaced the spoon. Now for me, that was where we were looking at going, trying to make it as pure and as simple as that. So, you know, I started with half a pair of vice grips. George started with you know, with a huge superpowered, it's got a motor, and then it'll give her extra strength, and it'll have cables and power. And so it was an ongoing argument between us that I was having trouble coming to terms with, and you know, he didn't want to give up on not, he wanted to more enable her, and I just wanted to do it within the physics and the realms of what little there was left, repurposed as cleanly and perfectly as possible. But we went on and on and on. We were right to the wire. In fact, George arrived in Africa and started looking at all the weapons and things we'd been building. I had him do a bit of a walkthrough, and he'd go and say, oh, I like that one, I don't like that, how do you kill someone with this, blah, blah, blah. And Matty Baug's claw in its almost finished form was laying there almost accidentally. George looked at it and said, and what does this do? And I said, well, we didn't want to give up. I know you don't want to, you know, the prosthetic claw that we were working on, but it'd be a pity to waste all that work. And yet, you know, it does look like something, and it does simplify how she'd be operating. Whereas, you know, George had gone on another line and had other people back at Dr. D helping design a 3D printed super lightweight giant orangutan arm that had circles and arrows on the back that explained where it went to and for. Mm-hmm. And, you know, giant powered claws and little motors that went putt, putt, putt. And we were very lucky that when Charlize came in for a fitting, she looked at the few options and started to tell George a story of how once on a film she chose the wrong earrings, and they gave her such a neck ache that, you know, she really didn't want to be, you know, didn't want to have her performance tied to an enormous, ludicrous, heavy object that would drive her performance rather than the other way around. So we had all these varying variants, all these versions. We had, you know, the different options, and we kept part of George's better enabling and part of our simplified and lightweight and part of the VFX's version that if we can green glove it, then we've eliminated, you know, 100 shots. And Charlize's chance to actually perform in a state of grace and not to have one of her arms operated by two chubby Kiwis in green spandex crouched down behind the car seat.
Doesn't sound great when you put it that way, I don't think.
No, that's part of my problem. I can usually find a way to make it sound really crap.
Yeah, you should have heard Matt Bell try to navigate the my two dads situation here with some sort of diplomacy. And like, he was trying to be so gracious and like, well, they both had really good ideas and I was trying to, you know, create something that would satisfy both of them. And the way he was presenting it, you could tell he's just biting his tongue constantly.
Oh yeah. Well, there's always a lot of tongue biting, but it's out of that taste of blood that's left in your mouth that something good often comes.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. You touch on in the conversation you just or in the response you just had. This film is known for its practical effects and its practical stunts, and what you see was what actually took place, as opposed to something that was created in a computer after the film was shot. Can you just talk even just briefly about having to, you know, pushing for that, but also knowing that you'd have to work with, you know, with some visual effects to bind it all together, even if the CGI for this film is limited to more, you know, blending and sort of making things fit a little better?
Oh, look, it's actually more than that. We had fantastic visual effects. Andrew Jackson did such a great job. And David Nelson and the rest of the guys. Look, I started from the theory that I was a CG agnostic, and you know, obviously we use CG all the time now. We're completely, you know, we're often working with the computer rather than with you know, with a welder. But I guess we started with the theory that we'll try to do everything for real, because that in essence was what made the first Max so great. The you know, one hand tied behind your back. We've only got one motorbike. The stunt guy arrived and he's limping already, so we probably only get one go at this. So we're going to try to do it for real. And, you know, we're going to make it as safe as possible. But it's that tension between safety and spectacle that is what's going to give us the tension, the strength, the conflict, the drama, and give it that spine-tingling, hair-standing-up sort of feel. So I worked on the theory that we do everything for real. Obviously, we didn't eventually. A lot of the CG came in handy. I would design parts into the vehicles where we could hide cameras. And then, of course, on the day, the great John Seal would come and say, "George, I've got this great idea. What if we put another three cameras, one here, one here, one here?" And it was only through CG that they could get those tiny takes, those little cuts that helped sell the story so beautifully, that helped demonstrate physics. You know, that was the perfect spot to say, "Fuck me, there is gravity, and this guy really should be dead, but he's not." And they could then use CG to blend out the camera to, you know, to put the reality back in again. So we went on the theory that we would do everything for real. We would make all the weaponry. We would make the vehicles. Everything should be capable of performing in battle and in film to the best of its ability. And then everything else after that was just gravy.
That leads me to a very simple question here. So you, in the course of this interview, have basically told us that you got to create a world and have a staff of people helping you to create a world, most of which, some of which was shot, some of which just exists in the imaginations and eyesight of the people who worked on the film. Here's my question. Are you spoiled now? Or you feel like hopeful about finding this experience again? Or would you rather not have that holistic of an experience?
Oh, I think the holistic nature happens with whatever the show is. You know, I just finished a film with Stephen Elliott, the Priscilla Queen of the Desert guy, who I worked on. You know, worked on that with him many, many years ago. And then we built, a world of Welcome to Whoop Whoop with Owen Patterson designing. After that, and this one was a flashback to the mid 70s and his childhood. And yet you have to still build a world that allows you to go back to that 70s, still be true to the period and to what was there, and yet heighten what needed to be heightened to tell a more comic version of what was essentially a touching and real story. So they're all real and they're all holistic. And you just have to find a different way in. As to whether I'd ever get the chance to do something as fantastic as Fury Road, probably not. You don't often get the option to build a whole new world from scratch. Like I said, George's oyster came with an awful lot of the ideas already there. We just got to flesh them out and make them real. And as you said, we built the world in our heads of Gastown, of the Bullet Farm. You know, we reinvented. You know, if they've got bullets, then where did they get them? They got them from, you know, blah. Okay, well, they're tilling the last grape, the Somme and the Passchendaele, but that version from the last great end of the world, the Carmageddon. And so they're ploughing the bodies, and you can make gunpowder from saltpeter from piss. Piss from the nitrous, noxious body waste that comes just after death. And so the bodies, the piss, the urine, the ploughing all gave us the plough cars and the rednecks and the guys covered in that ochre and dust. And so, you know, it's a great joy to be able to build a whole world, and I'm happy to do it. All it is you just start from a different moment. I talked to a Japanese company a couple of weeks ago about a show and suggested to the director that his problem was he was starting from now, and his alternate view of the universe. I said, "You'll help yourself a great deal if we just go back and choose a different point in time from where you begin your apocalypse. And, you know, you happen to start at Leonardo da Vinci instead of Elon Musk. You build a whole different way of seeing the world, and therefore you build a whole different future. So here's to us building a whole different future. Maybe I'll get to design a world post-Trump.
Right, I wish you would. You mentioned, short sidebar, you mentioned Welcome to Whoop Whoop. Apparently your nickname was Sausage Pants on that shoot, that production. Is there a story behind that you'd like to enlighten us?
Well, you know, like on Priscilla, the you know, you're working with drag queens and gay people, and at that stage, well, you know, late 70s, early 80s was very, you know, guys, us film technicians used to wander around in tights, so Sausage Pants could have come from that.
That makes a lot of sense. Would you? do you look at one point in time wanting to direct something yourself, like as the director, as opposed to just taking? Because it really seems like you've got all the pieces. You've considered all the things that you know, a director's vision requires. Is that something you'd be interested in, or it's just not not your bag?
No. All things are my bag. All things are everybody's bag. It's just a question of what comes around. So, Yuri, Travis, send me a script.
Don't tempt us.
Yeah, dear Sausage Pants, here's a great script. Please direct
it. The story of my life.
Yeah, exactly.
It begins.
We'll give you a chance to promote anything you want to say, but I have one final question raised by something you spoke of near the beginning. As we fall towards feudalism, if there were something you think that would be something that you think would be useful in this coming time, what do you think we should be scavenging now to use later?
Yuri just had a kid. That's why he's asking that question.
I've been thinking about the current administration and our fall towards feudalism a lot lately.
Great.
Yeah, no, I can see why. It is an ongoing horror. I don't know. The Burning Man people called us when we were working in Broken Hill, and George had come out to do a walk past and see all the vehicles and, you know, blah, 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 and did a quick video clip to send to them. And I do remember mentioning to them that as the world fell toward feudalism, the idea of digging a bunker and filling it with baked beans wasn't going to do your child very much good. And I wasn't too sure that the Walking Dead, waking whatever version of a land that had too many guns in the first place was the system. I'm not sure what you need to get, except fellow feeling, and a way to listen. I don't know. You almost feel like you need to design something with a slightly more open mind and bigger ears, because we're not going to get anywhere by polarizing. Our only hope anymore is to try to see all the sides and let everyone know what that adds up to. And then, you know, then you'll take the blinkers off and people will see how absolutely insane the version of reality in which you find yourself now.
Maybe we'll hire you to art direct the real world for the next couple of years. That would be okay.
I'll probably have to get a small crew. I'll probably need 4 or 5 guys. Is that okay?
Matt Bell said he's not doing anything right now. So by all means, please call him.
Thank you. I will take that in going. I'm always looking for lessons to teach my young infant son. And I thank you for providing even more fuel for my fire. Thank you for taking the time today. Do you have any parting shots? Is there anything you'd like to promote that people maybe haven't heard of yet, or ways to reach out to you online, stay in touch with what you're doing, either a website or Twitter or whatever?
Yeah, no, I'm keeping up my Luddite version of the universe. I don't Twitter. That seemed to have been taken over by your large fat orange man. staying well away from anything that sounds even vaguely Twittery. Look, I'm I'm around, I exist, I'm alive. They can always find you through me now. So vice versa. Right. You can find me through Travis and Yuri, and just keep those scripts coming in.
Yeah, big thanks to Julia for helping to make this this meeting happen. I know you're.
Yeah, if I hadn't been so rude to her boyfriend, I probably wouldn't have taken any notice of it.
Excellent. Well, we're glad you were rude.
Yeah, the best relationships are started through that way. That's how Yuri and I met, too. I really offended his wife. Great, man. Well, thanks for taking the time. This has been really, really fantastic.
I must be well balanced going forward.
Yeah,
I wouldn't encourage that. thank you for taking the time today, Colin. Thank our audience for continuing to listen. We hope. My name is Yuri Lowenthal.
My name is Travis Sintel.
This has been Colin Gibson, and you are awaited.